addiction and that it is a disease entity like alcoholism. There are some comparisons, there are some differences. Today we're going to talk more about... Oh, no, and the other thing I wanted to say was to just reiterate the theme that how intelligent you are, or how Christian you are, or how wealthy you are, or how hard you try, or how white you make your knuckles, it really doesn't necessarily mean that you won't have this problem. And lots of folks can listen to that, except when I say how Christian you are, it's kind of like we get into this dichotomy, because somehow with sexual issues, it's like, now that I'm a Christian, that shouldn't be my issue anymore. And again, some of the areas that I refer to is like talking about with a cocaine addiction. You know, I know Christian people who are addicted to a level and point of tolerance with cocaine, for instance, and how Christian they are may or may not have anything to do with that. So, with that, let me stop and refer to one overhead that I referred to yesterday. I want to touch on it again and then spend a little bit more time on point number four. Looking at the pattern of the addict, before I go any further than that, I keep getting these digressions that I want to make sure we get. And one of the digressions is that I don't think that everybody that gets involved in sexual misconduct or in hypersexuality is an addict. I'm not trying to imply that at any level, but I'm saying that some people that are, any more than I think that people who drink a lot are all alcoholics. You know, there are some people who drink a lot and they aren't alcoholics, and some people who drink a moderate amount and are alcoholics. And so that's a whole different story. But one of the core belief systems that we work with is that there is this basic belief that I'm a flawed person, that there is something about me that is not adequate, that's not fulfilled, that's not whole. And one of the things that I stress very hard is that because that person feels bad about themselves, don't necessarily assume that that person operates in the world in an inadequate kind of manner. Because they may be driven to compensate and overcome for that and be quite successful. Quite often when I work with school districts and we're talking about child molesters, quite often the teacher who is adjudicated and found guilty of this kind of problem is often the best teacher in the school. I have that as often as not. Somebody who's really, really good. So, you know, you can't make an assumption that that person is inadequate, but you can make an assumption that there's some deep down inside stuff that doesn't feel right. No one would love me as I am really plays into the secrecy aspect, because if I'm feeling pretty inadequate anyway and have built some dysfunctional ways to handle my intimacy, my lack of ability to connect with you, and I've handled that with some sexual dysfunction kinds of things. Instead of medicating with alcohol, I medicate with lust, whatever. I'm afraid to tell you that, which keeps me isolated, which keeps me separated from you. And I get this idea that if I told you the truth, if I broke my secrets, no way. You'd say you want to hear it, but you wouldn't want to hear it. And the second dimension of that is what keeps me in my secrecy there is that I don't have a good frame of reference. I don't know what reality is. Maybe you wouldn't believe me, but I don't know that because I got that package. I've got that compartmentalized in such a way that there's no way I'm going to risk that. The risk is too high for that. Third one is that my needs are never going to be met if I have to depend on others. I just can't risk, which also keeps me isolated. I can share with you in lots of other areas, but I've got this strata, I got this piece of me that you don't know anything about, which I don't have a good reality base, and in which I keep secret, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the session, that quite often is very shame-based, and it just naturally feeds itself, because in my shame base, which keeps me secret, I do shameful things, which I keep being shamed around. And I mentioned yesterday one of the comments that John Bradshaw has done so nicely, where he talks about shame is what you are, or at least what you believe you are, and guilt is what you do. And there's such a difference in that, because in your family, unless you came out of a pretty dysfunctional family, which lots of us did, but in your family, if there was a real difference made between shaming and guilt, what happened for you was that you learned that I'm okay, but when I do bad things, there's a way to get out of it. I can say I'm sorry, maybe I'll get a spanking or something, but the slate gets washed clean somehow and I'm okay. That's guilt. And I think guilt is wonderful. I don't have any problem with guilt, which might sound funny. That's a therapist saying guilt is okay. But I'm differentiating guilt from shame. And I'm saying, you know, when I do wrong things, it's not inappropriate for me to be challenged about that, to be held accountable, and to do something about that. And also let it go. And I can do that with guilt stuff, because there's a way out. With shame, and I want to talk a little bit more in a minute how that fits in. What I want to get to now is sex is my most important need. And that's so crucial for the addict. You can fill that blank in, though. You can pull sex out of there and say, food is my most important need. Or you can say, alcohol is my most important need. Or you can put in some other things. That's a fairly interchangeable word. But I want to move off of that theme of sex is my most important need to talk a bit about the need aspect of it. And what I do with that is I look at it this way. I make a continuum of intensity. And I start from zero and I take it all the way up to 100 with the idea that 100 is very intense. That's just a whole lot. And from zero up to 100 here. And I made, not very well, because art isn't my best thing, I made some emotional barometers here with the idea that I just want to get across the idea that you can need something and you can want something at an equal level of intensity. That's a thought that a lot of people don't really wrestle through too well. I can, and of course with the addict, the theme that I'll stress is that the addict gets it all mixed up as to what I need and what I want. And people who have better boundaries don't have that mixed up. But I can be in love, thinking of something John Schramm said last week, and believe that I need that relationship so much, and I can need and want and feel really good about that. And get close to that and have all my intense feelings met when I'm with that person. I can want chocolate really, really bad. I mean, have an attack. I notice sometimes I could, what'd you say the other day, Linda? You wanted a latte, just really wanted one. Now you don't need it. You're not going to die if you don't get it. But you don't get many lattes up here in Poland, and you can want one a whole lot, but you can also set your boundaries and you know that you don't need that. I look at that at both different ends of it. So the first idea that I want you to get in your head, if you haven't thought about that, is that you can want something desperately, but not need it. But you can want it so bad. You know, you hear people say, you know, that blouse is to die for. I'd crawl through glass to get that. Or that job, or that whatever. There's very little that you need. There's a lot that you want. What happens with the addict is they really lose the balance between what they need and what they want. Help me out. What do you need? Tell me some things you need. You're not going to exist if you don't get them. Water? Air? Food? Sleep?
Touch.
And I really believe that. Emotional, physical touch, some kind of touch.
Shelter,
at least something to keep the system where it doesn't get too cold, it doesn't get too hot. Okay. But see, we're beginning to run out. That's about it. You need those things, and if you don't get those things, you will cease to exist. we could spend a lot of time talking about some things you want, but just for fun, name a couple things that you want a lot. But yours could be different than mine, but what's something you want?
Respect.
Respect? Okay. A year-long vacation. What are some more things you want?
Job.
Maybe even a good one.
Yes.
Happy.
Mm-hmm.
Contentment.
Mm-hmm.
Health. And we could go on and on. The difference being that around the things you want, there's always choice. You may not think there is, but there are some choices. And what happens for the addict is the addict loses the ability in their own dysfunctional thinking that they don't have choice anymore. They move from the want end down to the need end, and they really believe that they need it. And they need it if it's going to cost them their family. They need it if it's going to cost them their job. They need it if it's going to cost them their respect. So the pastor that goes into the arcades and gets seen by his parishioners coming out, viewing dancing topless places, or has affairs and gets caught, or on and on and on. You think, how could you do that? Well, you see, when you get into this distorted thinking and you've moved that out of the area of choice because of the secrecy and the craziness that happens around the secrecy package, and you've moved that down to the need end, you think it's no longer a choice, and you'll risk anything. The example that always works the best for me is that if we decided to hold me down, and we're going to do a sensory deprivation example, you know, a little experiment here, and sensory deprivation with the therapist, and what we're going to do is hold a pillow over his face and get 10 people to hold him down, and we'll just see what that's all about. That's probably going to work with me for about 60, maybe 90 seconds. I could go along with it. That's kind of cute, little idea. Let's try it. And, you know, and then somewhere around there, I don't like this anymore because, see, I have the perception that I need air. So I will begin to do whatever I have to do to get air. Now, I also believe that that perception is a well-founded one, that I need air. But you've cut away my air now. So at that point, I will manipulate you, or I will beg you, or I will hurt you, or I will kill you, or I will do anything to get what I need. You hold me down for 3-4 minutes, I don't care about you anymore. You don't mean anything to me anymore because I've gone into a deprived state. And when I'm in a deprived state, if you deprive me enough, you don't, how kind you are, how Christian you are, how much you care about me, or how much I care about you, or what the risks are, none of that matters anymore. So what I'm saying is, for the addict, they move that, what I'm calling a real state of deprivation, and I hope you don't do that to me, because I don't want to do that one. They've moved that into the whole want state, and that's distorted and that's crazy, but that's where they are. And at that point, there is no cost that's too high. And then you get into the cyclical thing that I talked about yesterday, where the addict moves into the preoccupation and then into the ritual. And if you're in a deprived perceptual state and you're into your ritualized behavior, your altered state of consciousness, and you begin to act this out, you know, there's very little that'll stop you. There are some things, but I mean, I'm just trying to give a picture of what happens to people in that kind of sense. I want to say something because I talked to a couple of people last night, so I want to stop that right here and just make a comment so that we don't have a misunderstanding about something that I have not attended to since I've been up here at the village. And there are need states that people get into, and here I want to just go back up to this thing of the child abuser. One of the things that I want to make sure that I haven't spoken much about in the days that I've been up here is to make sure, if you don't already have this clear, let me at least make a formal statement about it, that there are, for instance, with a pedophile, which is a person who has a primary and that's a key word, a primary sexual arousal to children. We're sophisticated enough now in assessment to know that we can even probably tell an age range of primary arousal. One of the things that I want to make sure that everybody understands, because this can get, we can get sloppy about this in our understanding, as far as primary arousal to children can be heterosexual or homosexual. It really doesn't make any difference. And if you are heterosexual or homosexual and you don't have a primary arousal to children, you're not dangerous to children. Did I make sense there? So when we get into all these issues that we get into up here about whether it's right or wrong, for instance, for someone who's gay or lesbian to be a pastor, from a theological standpoint, you may have one issue, and from a moral standpoint, you may have one issue, but from a clinical standpoint, that's not an issue. Because someone, statistically, you're not going to find any higher ratio of gay people, lesbian people, heterosexual people that are pedophilic in response. There isn't any higher. Now, I don't want in any way, shape, or form, and I'll do everything I can, and you'll see me like old Don Quixote fighting those windmills and doing everything I can to have someone who's in a power position to have access to children. I'll do everything I can to stop if that person has a primary sexual response to children. I don't want that to happen. But there isn't any automatic that says that because someone is heterosexual or homosexual that they have that kind of response. So a homosexual pastor who has no arousal to children, that's not an issue from a clinical standpoint. And that was just a side editorial that I had a... Did I make that one real clear? I don't need to do anything more with that. I just have not said anything about that, and I was talking to a couple people last night and said, well, if you really believe that, then say it. So I really believe it, so I said it. Okay.
So or a teacher or a doctor.
Or a teacher or a doctor or a whatever. Yeah, that there isn't anything about... You see, this whole issue is an intimacy issue anyway. And we're talking about out-of-control behavior. And sometimes that out-of-control behavior gets stratified in certain areas. Sometimes it doesn't. For instance, I had a... Now, this gets tricky, and it gets difficult, but it makes a point. There's a fellow that I've worked with for a while who had an issue around compulsive masturbation and around X-rated movies. And there's no question, he's got an addiction problem. I mean, he's a professional person, he's bright. We've taken a look at what the background of all that is. It's very difficult, it's very complex, but it's also very specific as to what his acting out behavior is. When he went through a divorce, what happened, and I was able to speak very clearly on this because I'd worked with that fellow for about 2 years, and I have real clear understanding. You know, sometimes I'm not going to say something in a month or 2 months, but when I've worked with somebody 2 years around those particular kind of issues. But his wife, in the divorce, you know how it got ugly and all the kinds of things going on in a divorce, and she said because of his sexual addiction issue, she wanted him to have no contact with her children. Well, this guy's no pedophile. You know, I mean, that's a non-issue. And it became a non-issue in court. I wrote a report, and we talked about that. And do you see what I'm saying? That's a non-issue for this particular guy. That's not to say he doesn't have problems with a sexual addiction. But his problem doesn't deal with pedophilic responses to children, his or anybody else's. So anyway. That's my side editorial, and I wanted to mention that. Another thing that I wanted to mention, just because a couple of people have asked me, where are there places in the country where the... I know I do the work I do in Bellevue, but where are there other places? And one of the places you can call is the Sexual Dependency Unit Hotline at Golden Valley, Minnesota. And it's an 800 number. And here they will tell you, at least therapists that they've trained around the country, you know, because people are coming in from different places and have been asking me, do we have these kinds of training and groups and that's in our state and in our city? And well, I can't guarantee you that they'll have one, but this is a nationwide program, and so that's a number you can call. That was another little side piece that I wanted to throw out. I want to talk a little bit about how did you get here? You know, what happens? And it's not simple, but I do want to make a couple of comments about the person that gets into the addiction mode. Some of the things that feed into that, and I'll say three or four here. One of them is... certainly not any more significant and doesn't play in any more than anybody else, but is having been abused as a child. Now, there are as many people who were abused as children who don't wind up either being abusers or being addicted as there are that do wind up. So it's not a one-to-one correlation. I'm not going to say that. But there are a lot of people that were abused as children who wind up either being abusers or being caught up in a whole addiction mode. So that's one thing that may play into it. Another thing that may play into it that really comes out of the dysfunctional family is that their primary interaction in their home, and there have been a couple of studies done that have been interesting, which have kind of scared me, but have said that it may be more with their fathers than with their mothers. That if they have the emotionally absent father, even more so than the emotionally absent mother, it may be that that they have to turn somewhere else for their nurture. And in that turning somewhere else for their nurture, one of the ways, now there are a lot of ways that you can turn for your nurture. You can be an incredibly high achiever and work like crazy and get your fix that way. Or you can turn to alcohol, or you can turn to drugs, or you can turn to thrills and drive very fast cars. You know, there's a lot of ways you can turn. And one of the ways you can turn is to some kind of sexual behavior. Often it begins with what is stimulating and thrilling and often begins in some kind of masturbatory behavior. And basically what we're talking about is self-nurture. Is, you know, I talk to, and of course I work in a different arena than most of you do, so I hear these things. But I talk to people who get stressed and the only way they can get to sleep at night is masturbate. Can't get to sleep any other way when they're stressed. But look at what happened there, you know, growing up, being isolated, being alone, not having the emotional contact that we'd like to think that they had. One of the ways may be that I learned to self-nurture myself. And in that self-nurturing, I developed a pattern, which is now a habit pattern. That's one of the things that happens. Another thing that sometimes happens coming out of the family dysfunction, is that, and this gets a little broader, but that the child, yourself, whoever, was responded to more for what they did than who they were. And what happens to a child when, and I don't know hardly any of us parents that ever admit that, you know, we all intuitively, most parents intuitively know that's not the best way to do it, but we still get caught in not how did you feel, but what grade did you get, you know? And if a child is sensitive to that or hypersensitive to that or whatever and learns that I am valued for the things that I do, not for who I am, and has an early sexual experience or series of experiences that instead of working through kind of a developmental thing, kicks them off to one side, they can begin to find that I can self-nurture myself because I'm not really valued anyway. I'm only valued for what I do. And I can self-nurture myself in a sexual way, which then moves into, but that's embarrassing, but that's secretive, I can't talk to my friends about it, who's going to listen, I don't want to, and then it starts getting real crazy. Then as it develops over the years, it can get crazier and crazier because you never know what's real, because you don't talk to anybody about that. Hence, I keep coming back to the secrets, finding a safe place and being able to say, this is really frightening to me. This is what I do. And being able to, of course, we have groups where we work very, very specifically, and tomorrow I'm going to talk just step by step by step some of the things we do in the groups, to allow an arena where this is what you get together to discuss. And, you know, it's one thing to say, interesting idea to break secrets. It's another thing to do what in the Sexaholics Anonymous group, and I've got a Sexaholics Anonymous book over there, another one, Hope and Recovery, where what you do is go through a first step. And we've got some exercises actually where we help coach people through the whole first step idea, where you take your whole sexual behavior, all the things you did, things that you thought were crazy, things that you thought were no big deal, and you work it through and you say it to the group. And in fact, we try to do one in our groups at least one every 3 weeks and sometimes one every 2 weeks. And everybody knows what's going to happen. I can predict what happens. You know, you believe, no matter how many times you've been told this, that, you know, people's eyes are going to dilate and their mouths are going to drop open and you're going to feel shamed. And invariably, in a safe setting, in a group like that, that's not what happens. And what happens is a chord goes off in that person and their heart just breaks for you because they know how rotten you feel. And they begin to almost caretake you because they, oh, gosh, that must have been awful. And then what I do at the end of those groups, invariably, I do the same thing. I ask the person, how do you think the other people in the group feel about you? And it's real scary. Well, I don't know. I hope that. And then I'll have people one at a time. Give them some feedback. How do you feel? And most of them say, oh, I could tell how hard it was for you to say that. I can remember when I did some of those kind of things. Ta-da-ta-da-ta-da. Now, having sat through that week after week after week, everybody knows that's what's going to happen. But it doesn't change it. You can know it in your head, but it's different to begin to peel those layers off and break some of those secrets and start getting into some of that freedom that comes out of there. I have a letter here that a fellow who was in one of our therapy groups wrote to his parents, and I just thought I'd read this to you. He told me I could, and this was a couple of years ago, but this was after he got into some treatment. He'd been in treatment about 8 months for some sexual addiction things, and I just thought this would be kind of helpful. This fellow was about... I'd say about 28 years old, and actually I think he was in medical school when he wrote this. Dear Mom and Dad, a lot has happened in my life recently that has affected my ability to see clearly what is right and honest. This is leading me to make a disclosure that, to be honest, is a risk for me. His dad's a college professor. He's thinking, oh my gosh. And yet it was real important to him to break these secrets. Oh, I see, he's 34. Over my adult years, from 19 to 34, I've distanced myself from you. The main reason for this has been to keep a secret about my life. During this time, this secret has been my best friend. More than anything, though, this secret has kept me from being the person that I am. The secret has been my life as a sex addict. A few years ago, I became aware that having too much sex, or having sex for the wrong reasons, or having sex with myself compulsively, masturbation, is a disease. This knowledge, along with desperation to get out of this destructive cycle, has brought me to enter a program of recovery, not dissimilar to Alcoholics Anonymous. My program is Sexaholics Anonymous. It is founded on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and is centered around the 12-step program and philosophy. I've used my addiction to sex, lust, to medicate myself and not deal with reality. It has been a way to escape, to isolate. When I was younger, I used to space out. In grade school, I would pout and build up resentments. In high school, I would use drugs. In college, my drug became lust. Any relationship I began back then was for all the wrong reasons, not for healthy love. Much of the time, I was depressed. Often, I was not straight with people closest to me. He mentioned a brother and sister. Blank and blank are aware of my disease. I recommended that they pick up the, quote, Bible of Sex Addiction, a book called Out of the Shadows by Dr. Patrick Carnes. It's available at the blank blank bookstore over in his little town. Please read it. The book describes the disease and classifies addicts in order of severity. I belong to level one. I'm having a conflict in working my SA program right now that has brought me to write this letter to you. The SA program recommends a sequence of steps that one takes in order to maintain sobriety. The emphasis is to develop honesty in all aspects of my life, but each step needs to be understood and carried out in its given orders, in its given order, because I have such a close relationship with you in helping me with school. In this particular case, he'd gone back and they were helping him through graduate school. I am needing to jump to step 9 where I make amends. I believe that in a way it is unfair to you. You've not had a chance to see who I am in a long-term sobriety state and see the changes that happen. Just the contrary, since I made my initial disclosure to my wife, my family has fallen apart. It is my hope and belief that my wife and children and I will pull back together, but at present we are separating. I guess the only positive thing I can offer besides this letter, as a sign of things to come with my sobriety, is remembrance of the golf game that I had with you up in, and he mentions a little town. I had about a month of sobriety, and my mind has never been so clear. I felt at ease with myself and I could concentrate. He mentioned that because he played golf with his dad, and his dad commented, you seem different. It's really fun being with you. I have wronged you in two major ways. One, I spent your money to fuel my addiction by buying pornography. Two, lacking energy, I've fallen behind in school. At present, I'm a whole year behind, having just completed my third year, and they thought he was a year farther than that. I know that we've had our struggles and misunderstanding over the years, but never have you deserved the trespasses that I've made of your trust. I'm deeply sorry for these lies and the deceit that I have overtly and covertly perpetrated. My disease is at the root of my behavior. What am I doing to stop this destructive process? I'm in a level one men's group led by a psychologist, actually said an excellent psychologist, but I was being kind. We tell them to say things like that. The essence is to level with the group members about my weekly struggles and for us to give each other feedback. That's kind of a gentle statement. One of the differences in SA and in our groups is that we're highly confrontive. And I think that's real important. And I think it's real important to have a support group of SA. And I really like to have both. Also, we gather knowledge about our disease. The group environment is safe. This fosters honesty. I go to 2 SA meetings a week. Last week, I led my first meeting. It was kind of scary, but I got through it all right. Recently, I acquired a sponsor. In SA, a sponsor is someone you confide in who is long-standing in sobriety. He shows you the ropes and sets a good example. My sponsor, Bob, has 4 years of sobriety. He's a successful businessman. In his younger days, he pitched for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He's a real anchor and a motivator. Please call me to talk. Love. Anyway, that was a powerful letter. Now, of course, he had no way of knowing. They did okay with this. Mom and Dad did okay with this one. They didn't disown him and they handled it. But what became important for him was to risk writing that letter, whatever the cost. Because what happens for a person as they begin to get into some level of sobriety is they have to accept the fact that others around them may not be able to accept their commitment towards sobriety. Because what parent wants to know that all this was going on while I was raising you? What spouse wants to know that maybe everything we had was a farce? And on and on and on. So what he has to do in his commitment to his sobriety is to say, I'm going to tell you everything. And I hope and pray that we can get through this. But if we can't, I've got to do it I've got to get my life straight. I cannot live in this unhealthy way anymore. And if in doing that, we lose each other, or we lose each other for a while, that's a risk I have to take. It sounds kind of selfish, doesn't it? But it's something that has to happen. And as he learns to love himself and take care of himself in a vigilant, healthy way, then he can move on much further. Now, what happens with... I had a couple of more points that I wanted to say. What is he or she like? He or she, when they're in the pattern, one is that they're very compartmentalized. We'd like to think with most of us that our values and our ethics are kind of porous, you know. And we know that I picture us all like we're a pie. And sometimes in groups, in our groups, I have us draw the pie and it always starts with just a few pieces and then they get broken down. And you know, there's a part of me that's a loving father, and there's a part of me that's this, and there's a part of me that's that. And there's an addict part, you know, that's just self-centered and ugly and so forth and so on. In most of our lives, we like to think that these are fairly porous and it kind of pours through, but with the addict, it doesn't pour through. It's pretty set. And when you get into the need state, the perceived need state that I talked about before, where you think you need it, and you can't not go by the evening without cruising downtown and going to or finding a prostitute or doing something like that, then you move into some patterns. I say it's like the pie has rolled here, and that's the part that's in charge now, and it's running from the groin right up to the head, and that's taken over. Another thing that happens is that you minimize and rationalize. You can't talk anybody out of this. I mean, when you're in rut, or in lust, or in cycle, or whatever, you don't talk anybody out of that. You might take a 2x4 and smack them in the head, but you don't talk them out of it. That doesn't get talked out of. Although what usually happens is, around the issue, around the sexual dependency issues, you will see an enormous amount of rationalizing and minimizing. It's not that big a deal. I just kind of keep this stash of pornographic magazines. It's not that big a deal. Everybody does it, you know. And there's a tremendous ability to do that. Another characteristic you'll notice while you're in the pattern is, and you may not notice this much from the outside, but there is an incredible passivity and isolation to the addiction. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who's an addict is passive. Some people are reactive in other areas, but they're real passive around their addiction. Meaning they don't work their addiction. They don't do things to stop it. Tomorrow I'm going to list probably 20 things that you've got to do. And you've got to do them bam, bam, bam. And you've got to be right on top of it. And you've got to be active. But let's switch it to something that maybe is a little more familiar. What do you do when you're depressed? Probably everybody in here has been depressed at one time or another. What do we know for sure? Let me throw two things at you that if you're depressed, probably are going on. One of them is that you're probably angry at somebody and you swallowed it and you didn't want to say anything. I mean, there's a real good chance. A lot of times I'll say that and people think I'm such an incredible therapist because they'll come in depressed and I'll say, who are you angry at? And they'll say, how'd you know? Well, that doesn't take, you know, a rocket scientist to figure out that quite often swallowed anger turns itself inside my body to depression. The other thing you know for sure if you're depressed is the antidote to depression is action. Now, when you're really depressed, what's the last thing you want to do? Is go jogging and get active and get moving. If you will do that, if you will force yourself in to do that, it's amazing. Those old things that happen up in your head start pumping the chemicals through your body, and you actually get the same kind of stuff that you'd get on medication. But the addict has just as much trouble breaking the passivity and getting active about breaking the program as the depressed person does going jogging. I mean, I know I'm being ridiculous here in my oversimplification, but I think if we could get every depressed person into an active, vigorous physical program, there's a great chance that we could alter a lot of depression. But that's the last thing you want to do when you're really depressed. And for the addict, the last thing you want to do, for a couple of reasons, is to do anything positive, anything active about your program. Of course, one of them is that your addict really doesn't want to give up. There's a part of you that no, never wants to turn away from this. It's with you from the beginning, it'll be with you to the end. Carnes has a little Spanish term which I can't remember, but he said, and it's a three-part term, and I don't remember the Spanish word, and I suppose if I'm going to use the example, I should remember, but I don't know Spanish. And so, but it's a three-part term, and it's really significant to the addict. It's the worm, as in a tapeworm, that lives in my balls, in my testicles. You see, that's part of me. A tapeworm is part of me. But it's not all of me. And that's what happens to the addict. The addict has, as if something inside of me... Now, again, when we're talking about a shame-based disease and you do shameful things, it's a little easier to think, oh, I got a tapeworm. But that's not all of me. I am much more than a tapeworm. But that's a little bit more physiological. But to think, oh, I have this process that I have dysfunctionally responded to ever since I was a child, and that's part of me, but I don't have to let it run me, that's a little harder to grasp. And I'm absolutely convinced that the many, many things that we do in treatment of this kind of problem, the predominant thing that has to happen is the individual who's on the receiving end of treatment, number one, has to be there. They got to want to be there. And you know how we hope and pray in alcoholism for a high bottom rather than a low bottom? A high bottom means that you kind of catch on before everything falls apart and get into treatment, as opposed to a low bottom when everything just totally falls apart. And of course, I think the answer is always hoping that the person will get into treatment at a high bottom level before their life has really, really gotten so incredibly destructive, and they've not only hurt everybody else, but they've hurt themselves. But in that process, what has to happen is the individual addict has to come to believe here. And you know, that's the longest 12 inches in the world from here to here. They have to believe down here that I am more than my behavior, and I am different from my behavior. You got to understand that one. Or I said in Vespers the other night, the sinner but not the sin. Somehow, they've got to not just understand that, they've got to believe that, because until they really believe that, they don't make any shifts, they don't make any change, because the addict part doesn't ever really change. One of the guys in one of my groups gave me a good example a couple of years ago. Worked for me, made lots of sense. He said, with all the stuff we learn in group, what I do is, if my addiction was TV, then what I've learned to do is to unplug the TV, pick it up, carry it upstairs, carry it up a second flight of stairs, take it into the attic, put it way back in the corner of the attic, cover it up with a bunch of blankets, and then go back downstairs. But the TV's still up there. My addiction can come back anytime. All I gotta do is go upstairs, unpile the blankets, get the TV, bring it back down, plug it back in, and turn it back on. And I can be right back into my stuff. So what I have to do is recognize that what I can do is get my stuff two or three steps away from me. And I can really, really live a full life. But I need to be vigilant. We use the terms cunning and baffling. My addict is cunning and baffling, and he'll sneak up on me. And one of the ways he sneaks up on me the best is if he says, you're feeling kind of smug. You don't have this problem anymore. That's why we don't ever talk cure, we talk recovery. Again, like the alcohol. We just say, I got to pay attention to this. One of the ways you pay attention, and I've talked about this in some of the other workshops, just one, and tomorrow I'm going to go through, see, I'm teasing you, maybe I'll get somebody to come back. Tomorrow I'm going to go through 15 or 20 steps, just specific steps. But one of the crucial ones is you get a core group, and in that core group, you tell everything that you do sexually, everything. Now, maybe you only meet once a month. I don't care how often you meet, but this is totally open. And all I say about that core group is that they care about you, that they have some sobriety, that they're not codependent to you. You know, you can't manipulate them. You don't have, and there's more than one of them. God, I don't think any of us can manipulate one person. There's, particularly your addict can get so sneaky. That's why as a therapist, I don't ever try to work one-to-one with anybody that's an addict, because that addict's smarter than I am. No way I'll do that one-to-one. Now, if I got seven or eight of us, we can see through stuff together. We work as a group. Which, interesting, think about the core belief thing. So we do all of this as a group. But you've got a small group that you always turn to and you're totally open with. You've got another group that's somewhat larger that you talk about your stuff. But you don't get specific. You don't get detailed. Here you get real detailed. Every little thing. I was walking through the village the other day and I looked at someone and they bent over and I glanced down their blouse or whatever. You talk about every little thing to someone in this group. In this group, you don't get as detailed. But you say, yeah, I've been having a little bit of difficulty. Maybe that's your family members, maybe, but I'm working on it. In this group, you don't say anything to, unless it comes up. You know, working with the Christian community a lot, I run into a lot of people who will say, we'll get into this wonderful catharsis and confession, and I've got it all done, and I want to go in front of the whole church and tell them everything. No, don't do that. That's just not a smart thing. Go to your core group and say, should I do that? And if they got a brain in the head, they'll say no. Number one, the church doesn't want to hear that. Not some of that detailed stuff. Number two, some of them will crucify you. You know, we did that once before. And they will. They'll crucify you. Because it scares them. Because there's going to be 15, 20% of them that have got the same problem. They don't want to hear about it. There's a whole lot of reasons why you don't do that. Now, maybe in the middle group, you do go to your pastor and a couple of board members and you say, this is a problem of mine. And maybe if it's in a certain area, they'll say, well, I don't want you teaching Sunday school. You see what I'm saying? There's a certain few people that you may talk to some things about. But, you know, this group, unless it becomes appropriate, I don't think you should necessarily go to your boss and say that unless it has some direct effect. And I don't think you have good sense about who to tell and who not to tell. That's why I think it's important to have a therapy group. But beyond a therapy group, I think this group is more important. Because that group's going to be with you the rest of your life. That's your close support group. But think about what I said about the isolation. See, all the time now, you're building in a regular pattern of breaking secrets and not being isolated. And there's a real freedom in that. It sounds weird. Because it sounds like you get bound to it, but actually you get free. Well, I want to pass out a little test, and I want you to take it, and then you can take it home with you, and then I'll show you how to score it. This one is your private little sexual addiction test. Don't show it to anybody. Don't show it to the person you're sitting beside. Do with it whatever you wish, but it's just a little 25 question thing, and then I want to show you the responses up, not your responses. I don't want your responses. Take the sheet, hide it, don't let anybody look, do whatever you want with it, but then I'll show you how we score this thing. But I'd like all of us to just get a look at this. One of the things this does is give you a little bit of an idea of some of the things we look for in addiction. And has anybody got something to write with? I keep doing that, not having writing with things. We used to have some pencils
in here.
Oh, I see some. Well, a week ago there were about 15 of them. Oh, I love it. Thanks. Here comes one this way. Straight above. Got something to write with?
No.
Okay. Another test up, and so run through it right now. Or if you would rather do that, and I'm perfectly comfortable with this, don't write on it, but tally up your yeses and nos in your own mind, so that when I show you up on the board, you can see. Because I'm not going to ask you for that, I just want you to look at it. I'm telling the tape people that right now, for the next 5 minutes, people are taking the test. Yes?
I have the same question when I read it in the book. Number 3, can you clarify what is trouble with me? Anything? If that's my interpretation.
It's your interpretation of troubled with.
Okay.
Yeah. So it obviously is pretty subjective. How are we doing? Are you through my 25? In a cursory manner anyway? Now, what I want to say about that is that, I mean, that's a silly little 25 question thing. But what happens with it, in fact, at the Golden Valley program, and here when I did it the other day last week, and everywhere I go, there tends to be, for whatever reason, a comparison of numbers of people who have been judged to be sexually dependent in an inpatient program, and they answer a certain number of these questions a certain way. Now, I want to say before I show you the numbers that we play with, that if you have a certain number that you answered yes to, and that's all you need is a total number, 5 or 8 or 13 or 23 or whatever. You're just looking right now at the number of yeses. There are a certain percentage of those people then that would match up with the same questions of the people who are sexually dependent in an inpatient program. Two things that you can consider about that. One is you might have a high number of yeses and have a real tendency to be sexually dependent, but not be acting out on it at all. Because you are answering those yeses, tell me that you've got some real struggles going on inside of you, and you may also be telling me, and I'm hanging on, and I don't let myself do those things. I want to, I would say that treatment would be a real appropriate thing, but I don't let myself do it. So because you score high doesn't necessarily say to me you do it. It says to me that there is a real drive to do it. The other thing I want you to consider is that if you're at a certain point, there's X number of people who answer that way who are addicted and X number of people who aren't. So maybe it's 94% are and 6% aren't. But let's just look at that. Of the people in the Golden Valley program, and this has stayed consistent for about 7 years now, if you look at their scores, It doesn't go straight in a linear kind of manner, but if you go 0 to 4 and 5 to 8, you're still talking about a high percentage in that number do not match up with the people who have been adjudged sexually dependent. You hit up around 13, 14 yeses, and it really, really jumps very, very high, so that anything over 13, 14, you're going to jump up into, with 13 or 14 yeses, 15 yeses, 16 yeses, you're going to jump up into 95% of the people that answer with that many yeses either are acting out in a sexually dependent, compulsive kind of way, or has some real issues around that. Now that's really fascinating. What happened we had about 30 or so people in here last week, and I didn't get a chance to give those people feedback, but some of you are still in here. And I didn't hand out the sheets. I just put it up on the board and had people give me a little slip of paper and just give me their numbers. And we came up with a bimodal curve, which I think was just interesting. And I appreciated that because I suspect that, I'm not going to take anything up from you, but I suspect you all would do somewhat the same. When I say a bimodal curve, there were two groups in that group of 25, 30 people that turned their numbers in for me. One group averaged around 8, and the other group averaged around 17 in the group. The total group average was, for being highly addicted, for the group that was sitting here, was 20%. So there were 20% of the people in the group that gave me answers from, I think it was 17 to 23, somewhere in that range. So I had a group up here and I had a group down here. I just thought that was interesting. Wouldn't surprise me. I'll tell you why I think that would not surprise me in this group, or in any group here at Holden Village. I'll tell you why I think that. I think that folks here at Holden Village are a little more open to being honest of what's going on. You know, it's a little safer place, and I'm structuring this in a pretty safe way where I'm not going to know about you, so you're a little more willing to let me know, and that's why I can get a 20%. That's why I can get a lot of people scoring 17, 18, 19. I also think those you self-select when you come into this workshop. You know, you either have some interest or you know somebody's got some issues or you've got some issues yourself, so that kind of increases our numbers just a little bit. So both of those may give us a little higher because nationally we look at something like, depending on the stats you use, 6% to 8% are dealing with some pretty heavy sexual addiction issues. So, you know, we're probably only talking about 13, 14 million people. He said, tongue in cheek. So I just wanted to throw that at you. I want to make one more statement and then go to some questions and pretty soon we'll quit. My thesis about this, my belief about it is that it may be tougher to be a Christian and deal with these issues because I think there's just as many people that are Christians that are dealing with these issues as people that are non-Christians. And you know, you get into that, however you get into it, born again, new person feeling, and all of a sudden you still find yourself with the same urges, now you're really ashamed because maybe I'm not a good enough Christian. Maybe I'm not a Christian at all. So you really start beating yourself up with that. And I think that's a shame because your salvation in no way, at least I want to say it as authoritatively as I can, your salvation and your relationship to Jesus Christ has nothing to do with whether you're addicted to anything. It really, really doesn't. And your ability to have confidence in that, in your the security of your salvation. Now, to get into the kind of fundamental thing, I think one of the dichotomies that one pastor I heard say is there's... how did he put it? Now, it really impressed me so well, I've already forgotten. He's my Savior and he's my Lord. I think that was the term that he used. Savior meant I'm in a saving relationship with him. Lord means he's running every part of my life. Okay, may not be running every part of your life when you're in your addiction, but it doesn't have anything to do with your salvation. And the reason I'm stressing that is because I want people to know that it isn't like, well, if I'm addicted, I couldn't be a Christian. I see people just beat themselves up over that, and that's a horrible kind of a frightening thing. My last image, because I think in terms of images a lot, is that I talk to people, and I talk to people about breaking secrets, and like I said, tomorrow I'll give you 20 things you can do, and all that sort of stuff. But it's like this. When you've spent your whole life living in a secret world, and somebody comes along, a therapist or somebody else, and blindfolds you, and stands you up like this and says, now we're out on an iceberg, and you don't know where you're going, but I'm going to take you there, and you can believe me. You can believe me. This really works. And what I want you to do, blindfold, is I want you to walk along, and I'm going to tell you that there's going to be a hunk of ice going to float right up under here. There is something for you to step on. Go ahead, step. Break the secrets. Take the risk. Ooh, that's not easy to do. It's not easy to believe when you've spent a whole lifetime counting on the fact that I can't count on other people, that if they knew my secrets, they'd never tell, and here comes this person and in a figurative kind of way says, take a risk, step out there and do that piece, and there is going to be an ice floe that's going to come right under there and catch you, and you're going to be okay.